Aloha, I'm Bill Dorman, and today for Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, July 16th. What's happening with the Hawaii National Guard personnel currently in Washington, D.C.? You'll hear the answer directly from Governor Josh Green. You'll also hear his perspectives on the impact of the war in Iran on Hawaii's economy. Speaking of the economy, Hawaii ranked dead last in CNBC's ranking of the best states to do business. We hear about a plan to remedy our economic infrastructure. And an upcoming play at Manoa Valley Theater tells a story of second chances and sandwiches. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman in for Catherine Cruz. There's a lot going on today, and we talked about a good deal of it with Governor Josh Green earlier this morning. 27 members of Hawaii's National Guard arrived in the national capital on July 6th. There have been calls for Governor Green to bring them back, and that's where we started our interview with the governor. Governor, thank you for joining us today. Do you have plans to recall the Hawaii National Guard personnel that have been deployed to Washington, D.C.?
Well, not so much plans as what is going on is we humbly allowed 27 volunteers to go to D.C. to work on the America 250 project, not to be a part of immigration enforcement, not to be a part of the D.C. police operations, but just to be a part of celebrating this country. And they'll come back, I believe, sometime around Labor Day at the end of August when those celebrations are finished. You know, I know that there were people that are worried about that. I just have to say this, our National Guard's been great dealing with our disasters here. They dealt with the storms, you know, the terrible rainfall, they dealt with the wildfire, and some of them have been deployed to Iran. I worry about the Iran war an awful lot. So these are the things that they're doing, but this was not what it was conflated to be in the civil beat.
Well, to be fair, General Logan did say in a statement to the media and us included that it was dedicated to security and support to America Freedom 250 events and venues. The White House says that those are going to continue to early November. Any idea if personnel may be recalled back? And I guess I'm asking not so much that they'll be taken away from disaster relief, but just about the symbolism of that.
There's really not symbolism at all. We participated through the summertime, which is when the lion's share of those, those entertaining events occurred. There might be some competition or some sports games or something that they're participating in. I mean, a lot of the states are participating into the fall, but you know, we do have the fire season, and we always are here throughout the fall. This was a one-off because you only have a 250th birthday one time. And so, again, you know, I think people love controversy and they love to suggest things that aren't really reality. We don't support with our values any of the immigration policing. That's not who I am. That's not who the state is. But we do support the country. And the country had some celebrations as we turned 250. You know, when we turned 200, I was 6 years old. My dad gave me a beautiful red, white, and blue little bike, which I rode in the parade. And I was honored to participate as a six-year-old in that event. Jimmy Carter was president, and we didn't have these kind of fights because we didn't have social media or people in a cynical space then. So, you know, like I said, these 27 individuals represent us well, and they are kind young people. For the most part, they've gotten to volunteer to go. But we've used our National Guard mostly for natural disasters, and in some cases, they get called up to go to war zones.
You know, moving on from the National Guard for a moment, here in Hawaii, our primary season in full swing. We're told that later today the president's going to make some remarks related to election security. Do you have any concern about federal interference in the elections in any way? And how's the state prepared to respond?
Well, we'll see what the president says tonight. If there's any emergency declared that our elections are unsafe or insecure, we would fight that legally. They are secure in Hawaii. We have not had a problem at all. Sometimes we've had longer lines, but I'll remind everybody, and this is not political on my behalf, I will remind everybody they're going to get their ballots, if not today or tomorrow, by Saturday, and they can mail them in or drop them off. I mean, this is a three-week period where people can and should vote for whoever they believe in. So we have lots of time, but our elections are secure. We have not had fraud or any problems here in the state of significance. So I hope that the president doesn't go there. I'm sure that the attorneys general across the country will be watching very carefully, because democracy depends on an election that is not interfered with by any party, by any president, by anybody. And I would never do it, and this president shouldn't do it, and President Biden and other presidents haven't done it. So let's just call this a good democracy and let people vote their conscience.
You know, part of the politics and the environment these days does raise what's got to be a challenge for you. How do you simultaneously voice opposition to policies on a national level that you think are harmful to the people of Hawaii without damaging the financial interests of the state by opening it up potentially to some vengeful response from the executive branch of the federal government?
Well, I'm pretty careful. I don't make it personal. That's the way this president prefers things be done. When he senses a personal attack or a mean-spirited swipe, that's usually when the conflict arises. I don't do that. I call balls and strikes as I see them, to extend the current baseball season metaphor. We just had the All-Star game. And I just don't go there. I try not to. You know, I'm fighting for Medicaid. I fought Bobby Kennedy's nomination. I even told the president he's not MAGA, so I don't know why you're supporting him, because he wasn't good on vaccination. So I try to be analytical. When they had concerns about fraud or waste, though I don't think it's a significant problem in Hawaii, I still said, look, we're happy to work with you to make sure that we're not missing anything. So we started a fraud squad, and that met with a positive response immediately from Dr. Oz and the other leaders at CMS. So I really try to be civilized. You know, my colleagues just chose me to be the head of the Western Governors Association for the next year. There's tell or story that I'm going to get to continue on as executive in the National Governors Association. And I think that, because these are bipartisan organizations, is a reflection of just doing the work. You know, when I got the rural healthcare transformation, $50 billion into the federal budget, and then distributed it $10 billion a year to all of the governors, I think they appreciated that I wasn't playing partisan games. And I did that directly with the current administration. So you can see that I'm able to effectively navigate this. Now, occasionally it gets a little rougher. And I just try to say what we really believe in Hawaii. Meanwhile, the United States mainland folks, they do value us. Of course, they do a lot of their military training here. And we're constantly making sure that we navigate a sensible relationship. I hope that it will go well. When it gets a little bit contentious, I try to bring down the heat. And that's why I took a little bit of issue with a story that got written, you know, trying to create a wedge between me and anybody, you know, over these 27 troops. It's such a small issue when you compare it to the much larger issue of Iran, or the much larger issue of us putting hundreds and hundreds of troops onto the North Shore to help clean up after the floods. So there's a lot of that in the air. There's a lot of cynicism, but I try not to let it infect me.
We'll come back to some of those bigger issues in just a moment. We'll continue our interview with Governor Josh Green in just a moment. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
Ugandan musician turned political opposition leader Bobby Wine lives in exile in the U.S. That's after a crackdown by the country's authoritarian president following a disputed election. But even abroad, Bobby Wine remains deeply connected to his home. We speak with him about how he stays politically active in Uganda and the future of leadership in the country. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Oof Ta 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 features Jason Momoa, Mike Hayes, and Kenny Dale performing classic rock covers Tuesday, July 21st. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
We're back talking to Governor Josh Green. You know, Governor, this week it's hard not to think about the local impact of the latest developments in the Iran war. Since you and I last spoke, that situation's moved from progress to going backwards. And I know it's a difficult and changing picture, but I'd like to get your sense of the financial impact on our state.
Yes, it does have an impact. Of course, the persistent high gas prices are the easiest indicator to assess. We're probably all paying an extra dollar a gallon when we go to the pumps, and that's terrible. The impact that I worry about is any of our soldiers being in harm's way or any civilians that may perish in the region. Those kind of circumstances are just out of control, and they're awful. I want this war to end completely, and I'd like us to have a thoughtful diplomatic future there with Iran. I will say this. There has to be an end to the war. I did meet with some of those entities that come to Hawaii to bring fuel. I met with PAR yesterday or the day before, and they reassured me that they have been able to acquire enough fuel to keep, kind of a stable flow of fuel and energy for us. But the longer this goes, the more inflation you'll see eventually. It will have a ramification for everything, whether people want to be buying a new house or refinancing next year, whether they feel that they can afford that extra $1,000 for their kids' books in college, all those things will be affected by the persistent difficulties that we have with the supply chain and the price of fuel. So the war's got to end. I understand the need to make sure that Iran is not a nuclear power, given the threats that have been made over the years. But the other consequences are now becoming more and more significant. So I hope that we will get out of this messy war as soon as possible.
You know, as you say, part of the impact of that is on fuel prices, inflation on local folks. But, there's also a potential drop in tourism, as you well know. Are there actions that can be taken on a state level to mitigate some of that?
There are. I mean, I constantly reach out to our tourism team, and we have been investing some extra monies into promotion of Hawaii. We did that mostly because of the Kona lows and the floods that occurred, and we've recovered very nicely. I got to give incredible credit to our Haima team. They've done a great job, recovering. We're giving grants to small businesses. We're doing all those things, but we need people to be here, and we need them to support our economy. So I will keep advertising our state in a sensible way. We are very fixed on regenerative tourism. We're using some of the dollars from the green fee for that. That climate impact fee or green fee is effective already. We have not seen a downturn in tourism. Obviously, there are people who are questioning where to go. Because of the war, I believe, in Russia and Ukraine and the war in the Middle East, there's going to be a lot more attention to other safe places to travel. That's probably North America, and in this case, specifically Hawaii. But we have not seen a downturn in tourism yet. As a person, as a human being, I worry more about the consequences of war in general on our world. We need to find better ways to resolve our differences so that we can work on economies, we can work on healthcare, we can afford all these things. Because if we empty some of our coffers at the federal level, rebuilding the military complex, putting more missiles into play, that's just money that they'll find a way to take out of the Health and Human Services budget, which cares for those who are in need, like Medicaid. One consequence does not kind of survive without the other. So whenever there's economic pressure because of a war, people suffer at home one way or another.
You know, shifting gears a bit, you mentioned the Western Governors Association, and congratulations on chairing that. And as you mentioned, that is a politically diverse group, red states, blue states. You've said you wanted to use your leadership role there to bring a broader approach to healthcare with your Health Beyond Healthcare initiative. But, you know, listen, even your experience as both a doc and a politician, it seems we're past the point of being able to keep politics out of healthcare. How can you foster agreement within this group?
I use Jedi mind tricks and make sure everyone sees the wisdom in just working together. You know, truthfully, and I tease there for a second for your Star Wars fans, but it's not difficult for me to convey ideas without a truly ideological bent. You know, when I talk to some of my more conservative and Republican governor friends, I talk about return on investment. I talk about how when we've housed people, their costs are significantly lower. I don't know if that will ultimately be reflected in the audit that's been spoken about a little bit, but it is very real. People's costs drop by about 70% if they're not in and out of the emergency department because they're homeless. And when I tell that to my red state governor friends, they appreciate that. I think everybody appreciates a decrease in suffering. The more liberal governors like to talk about housing as a human right, but it also has the same impact. People suffer less, they don't die on the streets, and they don't cost a lot going in and out of the healthcare system. So that's just one example of many. But I got nominated for a reason, and that's because it is helpful to bridge some of these gaps. At the governor's level, we don't have the same fights that they have at the congressional level. It's very difficult to ever see, for example, Congresswoman Takuda agreeing with some people that are trying to take monies away from the Medicaid budget. And I understand that. In fact, I appreciate when she and Ed and Brian and Maisie fight for us and for people. But we don't have those squabbles at the governor's level. The government level is just different. We don't compete directly in some ways. And so I became the chair. And I will use this as a way to try to unite people. I actually see any number of ways to address things like even violence, self-harm, gun concerns through a different lens, through the health lens. And that tends to be able to bring people together. I don't know that you guys see that a lot because we are in the moment here in Hawaii, which is where we should be. But when I'm asked to go to Washington, D.C., I'm fighting for every American's health care, which of course includes the 1.4 million residents of Hawaii. And when I go to the national governors or the Western governors associations, I'm trying to lay a foundation for the future so that after this current era in divisive government where we're seeing some pretty serious attacks on one another, I'm hopeful that I'll be able to heal this country a little bit. And that's going to be my mission, you know, for the foreseeable future.
You know, you are planning to bring the Western Governors Group to Hawaii over December 7th. And so There will be representatives of Pacific Nations, Japanese officials here. You said this brings different opportunities for the group and for the region. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, the Western Governors Association, which has included Hawaii for a long time, has always been focused, of course, on the Western states, where most of our members are. But it also includes the territories. And I came up with the idea that if we were going to host, and obviously I wanted to host to bring resources here and to bring people to experience our spirit of aloha here in Hawaii, I thought, well, why not be a little bit more creative? So I've invited governors from Japan to come and leaders from all across the Pacific to come. And those are opportunities that we value. Actually, the Deputy Secretary of State was here and values that. East-West Center opportunities will be thriving during that week. And that week is a pretty interesting week because that is first and foremost, December 7th, of course, is Pearl Harbor Day. And we will work together to heal between ourselves and Japan and others. It's also inaugural day. And if people will have me, I'll be reaching out and giving a speech that day, followed by the arrival of Japanese governors and Western governors, and even a couple of the national governors' leaders from the East. So it will be after the midterms. I'll be doing my very best to bring people back together. And when people are in Hawaii, as you know, when we put a lei on them, when we, I will give them aloha shirts very likely, and when we wear slippers instead of business attire, we will be able to speak as people rather than as politicians. And I'm very hopeful that what I've been able to do as the vice chair of the Western Governors Association and other roles that I've had, I'm hopeful to do that more in the coming years. I think we need it. Personally, I think that instead of fighting over our 250th birthday and extending that into a fight about how we differ on immigration, I'd rather like to see us find common ground. And that's what I'll do in December. It's what I'll do for the next few years, again, if people have me serve. And it's important. You know, there are a few leaders out there that are willing to do this and try to cross the divide, the political divide. Because, you know, most people don't spend their days worrying about the political divide. A few too many people perhaps watch bombastic television and get semi-brainwashed. But most people would really just like to be able to afford food and housing and their tuition for their kids. If we could do that, we're going to be a great country.
We appreciate that, Governor Mahalo, for your time this morning. We appreciate it. Aloha.
I appreciate you. Aloha.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the distance learning executive MBA with healthcare and travel industry tracks. scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
Why are so many people caught in doom loops of sad or anxious thoughts? New research suggests it might be because their mental maps have stopped updating.
So you have this kind of recipe for, you know, turning on the sadness machine and then locking all the doors for other visitors that might interrupt sadness.
Fixing our mental maps this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we visit Honolulu's Chinatown to spotlight a unique structure located in the Merchant Street Historic District. Founded in 1873 and built as a hotel and saloon in the city's earliest commercial district, the parcel was sold to barkeeper and investor Walter C. Peacock over a decade later. The building standing today at the corner of Nu'uanu and Merchant Streets was constructed in 1890, just 10 years before a fire in 1900 wiped out the majority of structures in Chinatown. The red brick of the one-story building really sets off the white stucco adornments on the exterior. The architecture is a blend of Florentine Gothic and Renaissance Revival styles with cast iron decorations. Now for today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this colorful structure that's been home to the Royal Tavern, Jameson's Tavern, and since 1987, Murphy's Bar and Grill? If you know the answer, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
20 years, CNBC's been ranking the top states to do business and the worst. This year, Hawaii came in last place, number 50. Some of the reasons include the highest business costs in the nation, along with the worst infrastructure. Joining us more to talk about this is Sherry Minora, the president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii. Sherry, thanks for joining us. And this was not particularly surprising news to you.
It's not surprising news at all. We've been teetering between 50th to 49th, back to 50th, but it underscores the need to address our business climate if we want to build a healthier economy and continue to provide jobs, build better communities. And so, you know, this is a time, this is an opportunity to really hone down as what can we do to improve our business climate?
As you say, these issues didn't pop up overnight. Hawaii's long been near the bottom of this and similar rankings. Infrastructure was ranked worst in the nation, along with the cost of doing business. What, in your view, specifically needs to be done for some of the priorities for action at this point?
Well, we believe the problem isn't the number itself. The problem is not doing anything about it and not taking a comprehensive approach to address our business climate here and our economy. And so for the Chamber, we launched our 2030 blueprint, and essentially it's an economic action plan. And it's a roadmap to build a better business climate as well as economy. We launched it a couple of years ago, and we are making headway. We are making improvements in the areas where we were called out, whether it's education, whether it's the cost of living, et cetera. There's been a concerted effort to address that. And in those areas, we've seen Hawaii move up in the ranking. And while we've moved up the ranking, there's still so much more work to do. When it comes to infrastructure, cost of doing business, those are the areas we need to double up or double down and look for policies and come up with creative policies and solutions to address those areas so we can improve in those areas too and collectively move up the rankings.
You know, you mentioned the importance of keeping an eye on where progress is being made. Workforce development is one area where there's been some progress. What's been successful in that approach? Is there something that we can emulate, that we can extend, that we can lean into more, that to build on success that's been there?
Well, the state and the private sector have identified a generational workforce commitment, which is co-led with Hawaii Workforce Funders Collaborative and the Workforce Development Council. Essentially, it builds on WDC's state unified workforce plan in working in concert with the state initiatives addressing housing, cost of living, and economic development. So we're seeing more collaboration, connectivity between different partners, so employers, educators, and community partners coming together to address sector partnerships, which addresses the needs in key industries, including healthcare, technology, engineering, creative industries, and clean energy. And the goal really is to create more high-demand, high-paying, sustainable jobs. And so we're seeing more and more of that, which we haven't seen before. So that's very encouraging. And it highlights the need for not just one sector or stakeholder, but we need multiple stakeholders to come together and work together in identifying and working on a unified goal.
Are there any particular groups that you can think of that are not involved that you'd like to see involved or more broadly involved in that effort?
You know, we've seen more and more join this effort. And so even at the legislature, on the admin side, as well as business community, educators. So we are seeing that kind of collaboration, and we just continue to build upon that and add more partners to ensure that we can talk with one language and talk with one goal. So that way there's an active effort to work towards that goal in building a much more thriving workforce as well as economy.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned technology. Technology and innovation on this survey was one that Hawaii came in 49th. There's been a lot of discussion in recent years about how to promote an entrepreneurial culture in Hawaii. Where do we need to do better in that area?
Yes, we need to, so included in our 2030 blueprint, identified a need to address the entrepreneurial ecosystem, our small businesses, because as we know, they are the fabric of our communities and a majority of our businesses here in Hawaii. And so we need to identify what are the gaps in the ecosystem that we need to provide that support for businesses so that we can start more businesses and, more importantly, help them survive and thrive. And that's an area that we need to focus on because we're going to see more entrepreneurs coming in because as the younger generation thinks about what they want to do, we're going to see more and more entrepreneurs as a result of technology and AI. So this is a critical need, a critical area to address. And we have so much talent here. We have so much talent in the innovation sphere and technology sphere, and we're doing so much. So what can we do to ensure that the industry here can sustain and grow?
You know, sustain is such a key word there because you hear stories, anecdotally, you hear stories, and I'm sure you hear far more, but small businesses, startup operations that begin, that start to get off the ground, and then that sort of second phase where things get a little tricky, things get more challenging, that's where we see some failures generally in the business cycle, but particularly with that entrepreneurial, encouraging that entrepreneurial piece of the economy. Are there things that we can be doing in Hawaii to encourage to get past that secondary phase?
Well, from the public sector side, from a policy standpoint, rather, looking at policies that make it more difficult to run a business, whether it's more regulations, more mandates, because that's added cost right there. And it just makes it more challenging with the cost of goods and services increasing, with external factors making an impact like tariffs or disasters, etc. That already adds to the challenges of doing business here in Hawaii. On the non-policy standpoint, for at least for the chamber, we are launching our small business AI classes. So that's one way. We have sessions or professional development programs, workshops, where we provide support and advice on accounting, marketing, finance, legal issues. Because when it comes to the business side, you know, that's an area that whether the chamber or other organizations can provide support in helping our young entrepreneurs understand what it takes to run a business. Another great organization, Mana Up, who focuses mainly on local manufacturers and made in Hawaii products. An entrepreneur starts with a passion, and they may be really good at creating products, innovating products, but when it comes time to actually run a business, that's another aspect of ensuring a business is successful. And so Mana Up helps with that. So there's various organizations, initiatives to address that.
Sherry Manure, the president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to be on your show.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
I'm Anita Rao. Embodied is WUNC's weekly radio show and podcast about sex, relationships, and health. Join me to meet people who aren't afraid to question what we think we know about intimacy, who are embracing the unique ways their bodies shape their lived experience, and who have some fascinating stories to share about their relationships. We'll take on the taboo together next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from Malama Ola Health Services, offering individualized hospice and palliative care to Oahu patients in their residence, nursing home, or other setting. Available 24/7 at 808-543-1188.
like to take a moment and share some recent feedback we've received. We heard from several of you following our live call-in show yesterday. We discussed the future of local news in Hawaii and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs' exploration of a potential bid to purchase KITV. If you missed the program, you can head to hawaiipublicradio.org or find the conversation as a podcast wherever you listen. Sean from Honolulu had this to say about the changing media landscape.
Aloha. This is Sean McLaughlin, and I'm calling to endorse the Media Council of Hawaii and the work that Jerry Kato's organization is doing. I think keeping our journalism ethics at the forefront and paying attention to the ownership, media ownership, and the goal of localism, diversity, and competition for the marketplace of ideas is very important. I'm really interested in the idea of local ownership, and I think the example of Hawaii Public Television is maybe instructive that we have had a locally owned television broadcast outlet. It was actually owned by the state, and now it was transferred to a nonprofit.
We also heard from Dan Smith, who asked, would OHA subsidize local news and hire more reporters? What about OHA creating grants for local media to increase local news coverage? And many of you chimed in following our recent segment about the new look for Hawaii's driver's license. The new design is the first major change in 17 years, and it includes 50 new security features to prevent identity theft. But the design itself has drawn some mixed feedback. One listener wrote, it looks like they washed all the color away. I'm happy I got mine renewed with the old version. K-House said 100% should have given opportunities to vote. I had the old temporary license thinking I'm getting that one. I didn't. I feel, in my opinion, it was a valid crash out. And Mitz recalled, I remember that in 2000, my Hawaii driver's license had my date of birth and my social security number together on the card. They were slow to change and improve. We appreciate your feedback. If you have a question or comment, write to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also leave a voicemail on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. And now it's time to pour out the answer to the backyard quiz. Earlier in the show, we asked you to name a well-recognized building in the Merchant Street Historic District. After the Hawaiian government permitted liquor sales in 1862, Lower Nu'uanu Avenue became known as Fid Street. Pubs popped up everywhere along the street, and investor Walter C. Peacock opened a series of bars, starting with this building in 1890. Fun fact, during its reign as the Royal Tavern, celebrity patrons like Mark Twain and King Kalakaua were known to partake alongside wealthy shipowners and their sailors. Peacock also sold wholesale booze, mostly gin, from the location, and today these bottles are sought after as collector's items. The building has been home mostly to bars, except for a few years where it was a furniture store during Prohibition, sitting alongside architectural gems like Bishop Bank and the Melchers Building in the Merchant Street Historic District. The Royal Saloon Building still stands at 2 Merchant Street. We stumped you on that. That's today's quiz, no winners. But if you have one, a quiz that is, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
HPR is your source for music with culture. Every Sunday, we give you the recipe for a flavorful afternoon and evening. Start off with Kanikapila Sunday at 2 p.m.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kanikapila Sunday from Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Keali Iloma.
Mix in some Hawaii Kula'iwi at 6.
Aloha mai kako ke ho olohene o ko ya Hawaii kula iwi ma Hawaii. Public Radio 1. Ovono ke yo DJ Mermaid.
Then add a little spice from the Brazilian experience at 7.
Olá, minha gente. Bem-vindos à Brazilian Experience. Sou eu, Sandy Tsukiyama, com vocês. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Brazilian Experience.
HPR is your favorite hotspot, serving up the music that feeds your day. Let's keep moving forward together. Donate at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Now that it's almost lunchtime, how would you describe the perfect sandwich? Mayo, a little bit of bacon, maybe some banana peppers or a crisp tomato. That's just one delicious layer of storytelling in Clyde's, Manoa Valley Theater's last performance of its season. The Pulitzer Prize-winning play features a sandwich shop operated by ex-convicts. It's a story of redemption, hope, and the quest for the perfect sandwich.
Raphael, give us a break, would you? I can't even hear myself. Thank you, guys. You're too serious. Come on, I'm happy. I'm feeling life. I see those hips moving, Mommy.
Oh, be quiet.
I'll surrender to the beat Friday night. I'm taking you out.
Okay.
I'm going to show you love. Come on.
HPR's Kevin Allen visited Manoa Valley Theater during rehearsals and sat down with local director Jeannie Wynn Herring, who's directing Clyde's. With opening night just days away, her cast and crew were bustling behind the scenes to get everything in order. Herring starts with her recipe for the perfect sandwich.
For me, the perfect sandwich would be the right amount of mayo, a little sprinkle of lemon, bacon, any other meat as long as it's with bacon, a little bit of onion, lettuce, tomatoes, and a pickle on top.
That sounds like the perfect sandwich to me. I would love to eat that. And that is kind of the journey, or one of the main goals of Clyde's, is to the hunt for the perfect sandwich. How do we make the perfect sandwich? And what else is it about Clyde's that you think is so unique and special, especially for our Hawaii audience here?
Well, it's a very funny play to begin with. Lynn Nottage actually wrote this play. She was inspired to write this play after she did research for another play named Sweat. And she had met all these different people, and she was inspired by them. And so she wrote this play. She wanted to have the funny side of Sweat. Sweat was more dramatic. So the fact that she thought enough of the people she met to write an entire play to honor them is beautiful. And she said also she was inspired by wabi-sabi, the idea of not throwing away broken things, turning it into something beautiful. And that's the goal of one of our characters, Monty, or Montrellis. He is trying to take these broken young folks who are just out of prison and trying to convince them that they're worth something, bringing them together to create something beautiful. And that's what I find so special about this. You have former incarcerated folks working together in a sandwich shop owned by a person who was formerly incarcerated, and they learn how, through making sandwiches, they learn that they are worth something. And they learn it together as a support group.
Bringing people together to make something amazing, and people from all walks of life. Going into this play that is so critically acclaimed at a national scale, it's been done so much. Did you kind of go into it with your own ideas, knowing what you wanted, like a group of people who could get along so well together on stage stylistically? Or do you feel like you were able to kind of play with it and have fun?
Yeah, I feel like I was able to play with it. One of my rules is to never watch the play that I'm about to direct. And it's hard now with YouTube and everything because they're all over YouTube. I feel like that's important because if you watch what other people have done, especially that close to your starting production, you get influenced by them. And I always recommend my actors to not watch anything, any full productions or even clips of the production they're about to do, because we all need to find our own voice And again, that's what makes a play special, is when the individual finds their own voice in it. That's important for the actors. That's important for me as a director, our assistant, our designers. And with that, you're able to create something so unique. And like you said, this play has been done all over America. So when you find your own voice and you bring all the voices together, you have something unique to stand out.
Could you describe, I guess, how you found your own voice in this process? I mean, what defining features of your own experience coming into this?
I did a lot of research on people who were incarcerated, on mental health. Any aspect of the play I felt like I needed to understand, I did a lot of research. And reading the play over and over and over again and doing the research, I did find pieces of myself in there. I've never been incarcerated, but I have dealt with mental health issues. I have been shunned for various reasons. And in today's society, there's a lot of that. And with, especially with people who are incarcerated or have mental health issues, people will assume who these people are without even meeting them. And in my life, I have found that, being a Black woman with mental health issues, people make assumptions. So that's how I was able to find myself in this play. I also noticed in the play, some of the characters reminded me of people I knew. The role of Montrellis, I saw my oldest brother in that role. And so I think that was kind of something that led me to cast the way I cast, to see if they were able to capture that, the beauty of Montrellis, the zen of Montrellis, for example, and that's my brother.
And it must be a whole nother layer, that interplay between your voice and your take, and then all of a sudden your actors and actresses, right? They have their own voices and their own takes. I guess, what is that kind of chemistry like? You know, does it change things? Does it kind of add to new ideas? Or
I feel like as a director, my job is to present the message that I'm trying to convey based on what the playwright has written. What I always say is that the playwright has given the director a gift. The director gives that gift to the actors and the designers, the crew, and then in turn, all of them give the gift to the audience. And so with trying to find that balance between what my vision is, what the actors' visions are, what the designers' visions are, the best thing I can do is let them know this is my vision. You take it and make it your own. And so often I find something just incredible they come up with that I would have never thought of, especially with this group. With the designers, I simply said, have fun. And they did. Oh, it's a beautiful, just visually beautiful with the lighting design, the set design, the props. We have so many props. So bless my props designer, Sarah's heart. And even the sound, everything just gels together and looks so beautiful.
Opening night is coming up. Yes. How are you feeling?
I'm excited. I'm nervous, but I'm so proud of all the work the cast and the crew and the designers have done. I cannot wait for the audience to see this, the group of people be brought together because of their hard work. And they deserve that applause. And I can't wait for them to hear it.
We also heard from the cast of the production about how they embodied their roles in Clyde's Sandwich Shop. Jonathan Beck plays the role of Montrellis.
How would you make the perfect sandwich?
I make the perfect sandwich every day. And it's all about expressing art. At first, I get myself a fresh ricotta bun. I'll toast it, and I'll put ham, roast beef, a little bit of turkey on top, and then banana peppers, a little bit of avocado, sprinkle that on top with some salt and pepper, and call it a day. Pepper jack is cheese as well.
Did you guys all have to like learn how to make sandwiches for this role? I swear, so far I've heard two really good sandwiches so far.
No, what's funny is I'm actually a chef by trade, so that's what I've done it for 14 years.
You were built for this. You're
absolutely built for this role.
And as someone who literally comes probably from a kitchen to here, I mean, what are some of the similarities, the differences? I mean, how well are you guys, you know, imitating a real kitchen? What is that dichotomy like, just going from a real kitchen to what should feel like a pretty real kitchen?
It's exactly the same.
Is it really?
Yeah, it really is, because a lot of the stuff we use is exactly the way we would use it in a kitchen. And I had, you know, asked the, you know, the theater to provide certain tools for us to use, and we have it out there, all the way from the kitchen counter, right, to the two pan buckets, make sure we're cleaning things down, to the knives and the proper colors of the cutting boards. And so, like, go from one kitchen to another, it's like, hey, you know, that's red, that's for raw meat only, right? And so we practice how we train, right? And so this is how we can get into the mindset of chefs in an actual kitchen, is we pretend it's real.
You've been method acting for years.
Seems like it, yeah. My whole life's method acting.
Shervelle Hannah plays bossy sandwich shop owner Clyde. Hannah got her manners from her mother in Alabama and says the opportunity to let loose has allowed her to explore versions of herself she wouldn't normally entertain. What's her version of the perfect sandwich?
My comfort food is actually a sandwich. Just when I was a kid and things would get hard, my mom would always make me an egg sandwich, a scrambled egg sandwich. Now, as I got older, I would add things to it to make it taste good. And so just this past weekend, you know, I'm stressing over lines and stuff. And I tell my honey, I'm like, oh, God, I need an egg sandwich. And he's like, I don't like fried eggs. I'm like, you're going to love my fried egg sandwich. So I made him a fried egg sandwich, and I put bacon and tomato and lettuce on it. He was like, oh, my God, that is so good. And then when I fried the eggs, and, you know, when I scrambled it, I put the cheese, the Parmesan, and the cream in there so they're nice and fluffy. And that's what I did. It's weird because Clyde, she's like, she's bossy and she's big and she's yelling at them all the time. And in real life, that is not me. And she's a little brash. And I'm like, and so the first time I started doing the script and I started talking about it and I had to say all this stuff and I was like, yeah, Mara. And then I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I don't mean it. I don't think you're a moron. I think you're really smart.
It must be hard to kind of get into that role.
At first it is, because it's so different from other roles that I've played in the past. But it's also fun because I get to let loose. I go, I said that. Say it again. You know? And so I get to really like explore and experiment with, because I feel like every character, for me, I'm not being a character, it's just myself showing up in that space. And so for me to let loose and say, okay, I can do this, it's really quite exhilarating and quite freeing, you know, in a way. But it's this role is different from anything I've ever played in all the years that I've been acting.
That was HBR's Kevin Allen talking to the cast and crew of Clyde's, opening tonight at the Monoa Valley Theater. And before Friday's performance, local eatery Feast will be serving up lobster rolls. You can find links for more information on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's the program for today. Up tomorrow, did you catch episode 51 of Kilauea's ongoing eruption? We learn more about the record-breaking eruption and introduce a new weekly feature, the Volcano Minute. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to something you heard, find the conversation on our website, or Spotify or Apple. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.